artist's painting called The Head of a Peasant Woman. It was found beneath cardboard and layers of glue. Van Gogh is known to have often reused his canvases, working on their reverse side as well.
When he took the painting to Paris, he didn't have very much money. He was scrabbling around and decided clearly to use the back of these series of paintings that he'd brought with him from the Netherlands to Paris to explore self-portraiture for the first time.
Experts at the museum believe the materials covering the self-portrait were applied in the early 20th century before the art went on display. Art historians say when Vincent van Gogh was low on money, he took to painting on both sides of his canvases, but over the years, some of his reverse side paintings were covered up and lost. The X-ray image will feature at the Royal Scottish Academy in Edinburgh starting in July.
Children in Qatar are helping a conservation program revive the population of a critically endangered species of turtles. The children help release the baby turtles after they hatch, which usually takes place during the dark hours of the evening. The hawksbill mothers are cared for, if needed, when they arrive at the beach to lay their eggs. When the little turtles emerge, the weaker ones are taken to facilities at the foundation. There, they are cared for until they are strong enough to be returned to sea. Program managers say getting children involved helps raise awareness about the endangered species and how they can help prevent some of the challenges these turtles face.
As adults, we are kind of beyond hope. Our brain is no longer plastic. We can't really learn new things. But children have the power to really internalize all these things that they're learning, that they're seeing. They make these habits part of their life. They make decisions based on, is it good for the environment, alongside with economic value for money kind of decisions. And this is what we want to cultivate.
The children also get a chance to form bonds with the hawksbill turtles. Some of them have even named the one they are going to release. That's why life experts with the conservation program say only 1% of every 1,000 hatchlings make it to adulthood. Poaching, climate change, fishing nets and marine pollution have all contributed to the dwindling numbers of the species. The program was launched roughly a decade ago and has released 30,000 hatchlings into the sea in the last 5 years. Experts are optimistic about the success of the program.
The more scientists make progress in space exploration, the more they get persuaded to delve into the mysteries of the universe. Now, the release of stunning full-color images from deep in the cosmos has put astronomers on the edge of their seats. NASA has unveiled high-resolution pictures from its James Webb telescope, which is the largest space-based observatory ever launched. The images took 2 weeks to render from raw telescope data. The $9 billion infrared James Webb was launched on Christmas in 2021. It reached its destination in solar orbit nearly 1 million miles from Earth a month later. Then the telescope underwent months-long process to unfurl all of its components. James Webb is now finely tuned and fully focused. The telescope is expected to shed light on the life cycles on planets of planets and galaxies.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
The International Fajj Fashion and Clothing Festival has drawn fashion designers from Iran and around the world. The designs displayed are trendy and at the same time they conform to the Islamic dress code. Yusuf Jalali has this report.
It's the Iranian fashion's biggest day. The 11th Fashion and Clothing Festival brought under one roof fashion designers from across Iran and some other Muslim nations to step up their designs.
I have participated here as a fashion designer. I am so happy to be a part of this event because it acts as a platform that links designers to producers and it helps like promote quality design in the market.
This festival is a major event in the Islamic world's fashion industry because it helps promote fashionable clothes that conform to Islamic guidelines.
A typical Iranian woman wears a button-up coat called manto and a scarf covering the head. Some others wear a piece of cloth called chador, which covers the body from head to toe. One of the challenges Iranian fashion designers have to deal with is to tailor their designs to Islamic dress code or hijab while keeping them trendy.
Clothes represent the identity of a nation. As a designer, my mission is to design clothes that best represent the dresser's nationality and their culture. At the same time, the aesthetic aspect of the garment need to catch the attention. I think this is an ultimate artistry if accomplished.
Smuggling is another persisting problem in the Iranian clothing industry. Out of the $8 billion annual turnover of Iran's garment industry, a whopping $5 billion is supplied through smuggling, say activists here. Experts say one of the reasons smuggling has the lion's share in Iran's clothing market is that it's more cost-effective to import foreign clothes rather than produce them domestically.
We are making our best efforts to push down the production costs, including the associated taxes, in order to promote designs that reflect our Islamic and Iranian identities, opposed to Western designs that seek to dominate global markets.
With all the actors in Iran's fashion industry present in the Fajr Festival, the event is seen as a place to highlight and address the challenges with the aim to provide the stage for Iranian fashion activists to shine in the domestic market.
It might seem contradictory when we would associate fashion with the Islamic dress code, but it's the art of a fashion designer that sews traditions to style and designs clothes that are both stylish and hijab. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Elephants are the largest living animals on earth that in many cultures are associated with good luck, wisdom and fertility. But their overpopulation has become a matter of concern in the southeastern African nation of Malawi.
We want to reduce the population of elephants in this park, in Luanda National Park, because currently we have 600 plus elephants in this park. We would be comfortable, ecologically speaking, that is, to have 300 elephants in this park.
Officials say they will relocate 250 elephants from a national park in a southern town to another park by the end of July. They say the plan is part of a national conservation initiative to maintain healthy habitats in the country's national parks. Establishing viable elephant populations and ensuring the prosperity of local communities around the parks are said to be the other aspects. Residents say the elephants often stray into their gardens and damage their crops. Authorities had relocated some 300 elephants from the same town in 2019.
A zoo in Mexico City celebrates the birthday of two very special residents, bringing cheers and excitement to visitors. Chinese pandas Xin Xin and Xuan Xuan have turned 35 and 33, becoming the oldest pandas in human captivity. China gifted their ancestors to Mexico back in 1975 to boost the relationships between the two countries. Later on, and thanks to the hard work of caretaker teams, 8 cubs were born from the parents. Zoo officials say for them, learning the A to Z of panda care was a long journey.
The pandas living in Chapultepec, Xuan Xuan and Xin Xin, turned 35 and 33 years old, respectively. When their parents arrived, we didn't know much about pandas, so vets and biologists had to follow recommendations from those who took care of giant pandas in the People's Republic of China. From then on, we evolved. We found new and better diets and daily care practices such as vaccine administration or parasite removal. Then they started to breed, which was quite a success since it was the first panda that was born and which survived named Toy.
The birthday celebration has coincided with the zoo's 99th foundation anniversary. A panda's normal lifespan is estimated at about 15 to 20 years for those out in nature and about 30 years for the ones in human care. But the good news is, despite their old age, Xuan Xuan and Xin Xin are in perfectly good shape. A goat in the Pakistani city of Karachi has made the headlines for its not-so-ordinary looks. The animal owns strikingly long ears. Simba was only born last month, and his ears have already reached the length of 54 centimeters. The goat's breeder, Muhammad Hassan Narejo, says he has approached Guinness World Records to see if Simba can be included as the greatest of all time, or the goat, for this peculiar feature. The kid is in the center of attention, so he receives all sorts of help to live a smoother life. This includes a special harness for his ears and daily religious rituals to wish him good health. The breeder says that by promoting Simba's image, he is trying to introduce Pakistan as a major goat breeding nation.
The sky is the limit for wind sports in Iraq's Kurdistan region as members of the paragliding team launched into the sunset. Tourists have also come to watch team members bravely run towards the edge of the cliff of Mount Asmar. They usually take off facing the west to catch the sunset and then glide down towards the grey green meadows. The windy landscape around Iraq's northeastern city of Sulaymaniyah is a hot spot for paragliding. Participants of the sport say it requires a lot of physical strength and mental concentration. Some say their favorite aspect of the activity is the intense silence when flying high above the ground.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to answer your questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. While on that note, we have with us in our studio today Mr. Salman Akavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and an Islamic researcher in the Hafza Almi of Qum. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Nakavi, in our previous sessions, we have been talking about how we can help our children, help the management of faculties, that's physical, mental, and emotional level, and how they can make use of those faculties in particular time. And we talked about time management in the previous session. That's extremely important, and we covered many aspects in time management, how we can teach our children time management. In general, we had been talking about the domains of behavior, where we talked about the mental maturity, mental development. What else would you like to add on the note?
So, yes, we were talking about, we were still focusing on the relationship one has with himself or herself. So we were talking about one of the things is managing our resources.
Yes.
Certainly we have God-given resources, inherent resources, mental capacities, physical aspects of our bodies. Then we have the time, which is without, not in our control.
Not in our control.
Then we have our personal belongings to manage. Our clothes, our household things, our books.
Our accessories.
Our access, everything that belongs to me, I have to take care of them. I have to learn how to take care of them, how to maintain them, how to keep them. I mean, if I have a copy, I have to manage. I have a copy which, or a book which I need to study. I should learn how to keep it covered, make a cover of it.
Yeah.
I should be able to, so many children, they, you know, start using their books and copies and they start tearing them apart. So we need to keep them neat and tidy.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to learn that. So maintaining those things which are our belongings. And then I talked about the financial aspect. Also pocket money, if I've reached an age where I can be given pocket money, I should be given pocket money. I should be given the responsibility to go and use it properly.
Yes.
I should be able to learn what to use it for.
Yes.
And to maintain a record of that. I should be able to give a record of what I have spent.
Yes.
I should be able to kind of gradually make a diary or an account book.
Yeah.
And then at a later age, even before I'm still studying, but I should be able to go and even work for some person, some organization, some charity work and earn some money.
Yes.
To extend my resources. So I be able to learn that. I have to be able to manage my hobbies.
Okay.
Every child should have a special hobby, a pastime, painting, coloring, anything which can be... Can tomorrow, even when I go for a special profession, I have a hobby, a pastime, something which enhances my cultural and aesthetic aspect in my life, within me. The beauty, the love of beauty which is there, God-given, inherent nature, I am after beautiful things. I have to be able to be creative about them. I have to be able to even understand the beauty in the creation of Allah Almighty.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be able to replicate that. For people go for many different fine arts.
Yes.
So all of these have to be developed at that tender age.
Yes, and if a child is exploring all that, we see like my child is interested in a particular thing, I as a parent have to act as to him, like to explore his talent, help him explore
his
talent.
I want to develop scientific
skills in my child, yeah.
Or mechanical skills.
Yes, and how
he
parents
or she should be able to, for example, tear up his toy,
yes.
Break it up and build it again.
And if he is able to break it up, how he's able to make it up again, how parents can help on all that. I'll be talking to you on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing from IRIB English Radio. Yes, brother, you were saying that if a child breaks apart toys, he should be able to make up them again. And all those skills have to be taught by parents.
I mean, at least parents should facilitate them.
Yeah.
Or he should be able to play with clay, model things,
yeah.
Sculpture things.
Yeah.
I mean, everything which enhances his creativity.
Yeah.
There's one mental creativity which is there,
mm-hmm.
and that should come out in the form of creativity using your psychomotor skills.
Yes.
I mean, learning to even cook, learning to garden, learning to, for example, knitting. I mean, some pastimes are there for girls. There are certain pastimes for boys. There are certain things which are common.
But unfortunately, in many cultures, they are. It's thought that there are all these pastimes only for girls. They don't belong to boys.
No, everything. Oh, going out for outings, going into the open air.
Yeah.
Recreation, mountaineering, climbing, all of these things, different sports. The more we engage our child in such activities, mm-hmm. the more he's going to be
developed
mentally and physically. And especially when it comes to adolescence, which is a very critical age. That is where we have to control that. And if we don't prepare for that at an earlier age, and we're not keeping him engaged in all these activities and making him manage his time, even he should have a time. Okay, this is time for TV. 1 hour, 2 hour, not more than that.
Okay.
This time is for studies. This time is for leisure. This time is for playing. Time management, controlling his temperament, controlling his feelings, emotions,
mm-hmm.
letting them out. I mean, a child should know, especially till the age of 7, screaming, crying, everything should be allowed.
Let him do it.
Because if we suppress that, it will come out at a later age.
Yes.
Now,
because most of the parents living in some apartment kind of life, they try to suppress their children. Even if they are 3, 4, they don't allow them to scream much. No, we are living in an apartment kind of life.
Unfortunately, that is a part of this new type of living, this
new
modern
type
living.
Of living. Yes.
But okay, inside the apartment, you have a difficult time. Go take him out. Let him scream as much. Let him play in the dirt. Let him get. Dirtied.
Leave him on his own. Leave him free.
Free. Let him express his feelings.
Yeah.
Pour out his feelings.
Mm-hmm.
The more a child is able to do that at a tender age, at a later age, he's much more
mature and developed. Okay.
And then at the end, the relationship with ourselves, the last thing which is important, he should be taught how to become a good student.
Okay.
Managing his education.
Yeah,
he should be able to manage his education. What should he learn to be able to manage these four relations?
Yes.
He himself, not at the early age, but at least in the second 7 years that comes after the first 7 years, the second 7 years, when he's supposed to be a servant.
Kind of responsible.
Responsible, and he has to pick up responsibilities for himself. Educational planning for himself.
Okay.
What to study, what to learn, how to learn, study skills.
What can help a child in that? I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Imam Kadhim alayhi salam said, "It is a recommended practice for a child to play in his childhood so that he becomes patient in his adulthood."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We talked about so many things. We talked about time management. We talked about financial management. We talked about keeping record of what a child spends, where he spends. We talked about exploring his skills, exploring his psychomotor skills, exploring his financial skills, and so many other things. What else is in the store?
So, as I said, at the end of it, we have the most important thing, which is, for example, education as a whole.
Yeah.
He should understand the scope of that learning is quite great. It's not just focused on education for the sake of a profession, for earning money.
Yeah.
That is one aspect.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not the only thing. He should start to understand that he has to learn about the whole of the creation around him, himself, his creator. He has to develop a sound worldview.
Okay.
And a strong ideology based on that worldview. His education starts from this. He starts understanding who he is as a human being.
Yes.
What is his role in the scheme of things that Allah Almighty has created?
Undoubtedly.
And starting to understand the purpose of life.
Yes.
And then what he has to do to manage this life.
Yeah.
In the way Allah Almighty wants us to do so. So this education starts from that.
Really tender age.
Yes, it should start. I mean, if the child, if he is listening, he's learning from his parents that they're talking about in this context.
Yes.
They're not trying to make him a triple M.
Yes.
That is money-making machine.
Exactly.
Because nowadays our children
that's what parents are doing.
I want you to become a doctor. I want you to become an engineer. I want you to become so-and-so. So you become a good professional, start earning money, take care of your family, and when we get grown up, take care of us. That is the whole focus of his life.
Yes.
Yes, I have religious obligations. I'll take care of them.
But they come as secondary, you know.
Even if they're primary, but yeah. This is the focus of life. That is not what Islam wants us to be.
Yes, yes, indeed.
I mean, we have this worldview, this ideology.
Yeah.
We have a greater purpose in life.
Yes. We have to teach our children where did they come from, why did they come, what is their goal in the life, where they have to go, rather than, as you put it very correctly, making them triple M, a money-making machine. So that's not the purpose of life. We have to teach them the entire purpose of our life is to attain perfection. And how we can do that, Islamic upbringing helps you with all that. It gives you all those points, all that knowledge, all that education that is required to attain that perfection. Mr. Nakavi, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for being with us. And thank you so much for providing us such a detailed information on that, how we can educate our children in these all these fields in all, and how can we develop all those skills. Thank you so much, dear listeners, who are listening to IRIV English Radio. In case you have any questions for us, you have any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on these social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also download our programs on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah. God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
که انسان را مطمئن می‌کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
The people regard Her Holiness Masuma as the daughter of their own imam, that they kiss her mausoleum. The mausoleum is the bit of gold and a little iron. Why do they kiss this iron and gold? There is a lot of iron and gold in the world. Well, they even earn coins, but do they ever kiss them? This motivation is the affection of the people for the origin. Why do they kiss the Hajar al-Aswad and touch it and seek its blessings? Why do millions of people circumambulate a house made of mud and stone every year? It is because their motivation is a divine motivation.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Shiism. In one of his speeches, he refers that we are honored that the book Nahjul Balagha, which after the Quran is the greatest code of material and spiritual life and is the greatest book for the salvation of mankind and whose spiritual and political commands are the most sublime way for salvation, is from our infallible Imam, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam. Now, obviously, when we have precious things, when we have something which has no other copy, when we have something which we can proud to be on, it is necessary to talk about that. It is necessary to be thankful about that. And it is necessary to convey the message, to tell people, to make people aware that such a thing that we have, which we can be proud of. And this is what Imam Khomeini is also referring to. And he says that we are proud to have Nahjul Balagha. And we are proud to have it. Why? Because this is a book, a compilation of Sayyid Razi from the speeches, from the letters, and from the sayings of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi, sallallahu alayhi.
Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib is our first Imam. He is the person who we are following after the Prophet. Now, if we look at the text which we have in the Nahjul Balagha, it is a speech which is lower than the Quran or the words of Allah, and which is above the speech and the words of the mankind. Now, when we have such a treasure with us, we must be proud of that. Why? Because right after the Prophet, we are following such a person. We are following the Nahjul Balagha. We are following the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam, who is an infallible Imam. And right after the Prophets, when we are following the teachings of the Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, then definitely we are going towards the paradise, then we are successful. Why? Because it is a narration of Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. The companion of the Prophet, Abu Bakr, has said that I have heard Prophet say that Al-Hasan wal-Husayn sayyida shababi ahli al-jannah wa aliyun afzaluhuma wa abuhuma afzaluhuma. I have heard that the Prophet said that the Hasan and Husayn are the masters of the paradise and their father is superior from them. Therefore, we are following a school of thought, we are following such an infallible imams who are the masters of the paradise, and we are proud to have Nahjul Balagha with us today.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss how the tradition of Qawwali, a blend of music and mysticism in praise of Imam Ali, gained astounding popularity in South Asia over the centuries. And we shall also take a look at the dramatic turn in the months-long protests in Sri Lanka, with demonstrators laying siege to residences of President and Prime Minister.
A celebration of divine, unadulterated love that transcends the boundaries of caste, color, and creed, Qawwali is a seamless fusion of music, spirituality, and mysticism. It's rooted in the Persian and Indian linguistic and cultural traditions that gained popularity in South Asia, courtesy of ascetics, mystics, and scholars of Islam. At the heart of this timeless Sufi tradition is Ali ibn Abi Talib, the first Shia Imam. Qawwali is sung essentially in praise of his lofty virtues, bravery, sagacity, and asceticism.
The profoundly spiritual and mystic melody associated with Qawwali seeks to bring listeners closer to the Almighty and His best creation. It starts with Hamd as an expression of gratitude and gratefulness for Allah. It then moves to Nat, the panegyric verses in praise of Prophet Muhammad, before the final and most critical element of Manqabat that eulogizes Imam Ali.
There's something in Qawwali which attracts everybody, attracts someone, attracts your inner, attracts your soul to be listened.
Dating back to the 13th century, the path-breaking tradition of Qawwali was introduced by Amir Khusro Dehlavi, the celebrated Indian Sufi saint and a disciple of Hazrat Nizamuddin, a Sufi luminary whose popular shrine in Delhi reverberates with the soulful tune of Qawwalis today. One of the most famous Qawwalis of Amir Khusro is derived from the prophetic tradition Man Kuntu Mawla, Prophet Muhammad's historic declaration at Qadir Khum in 10 Hijri that Ali is his worthy successor, which has been immortalized by legendary Sufi artists, including Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, Abida Parveen, and Sabri Brothers. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan's famous Urdu Qawwali, Ali Mawla, declares that knowing Ali is knowing Allah. While one Punjabi Qawwali says, truth is Ali. Ghulame Ali is another timeless Sufi hymn in honor of Imam Ali, which reveals astounding devotion to Imam Ali through the spiritual, meditative experience of Qawwali.
Dating back to the 13th century, the tradition of Qawwali gained massive popularity in the 20th century, with legendary South Asian artists taking it to the global stage. Most Qawwalis today are in Hindi, Urdu or Punjabi languages, but the influence of the Persian language is hard to miss. In recent decades, the traditional art of Qawwali has been modernized by prominent artists in India and Pakistan, and mainstream cinema in India has also enthusiastically adopted it.
Amir Khosrow Dehlavi, who belonged to the Chisti order of Sufis, pioneered the mystic art of Qawwali through his epic rendition of Man Kuntum Mawla in the late 13th century. Over the centuries, other soulful Sufi melodies made their way into the Qawwali repertoire, popularized in the 20th century by the likes of Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, Sabri Brothers, Abida Parveen, and Farid Ayaz. Essentially in praise of Imam Ali, Qawwalis are today performed in both Shia and Sunni gatherings in South Asian countries as a symbol of syncretic culture. Quite remarkably, with the advent of satellite television and digital technology, Qawwalis have crisscrossed long distances. In India, artists such as Oscar winner A.R. Rahman made Qawwalis trendy with chartbuster songs like Khawja Mir Khawja and Kun Faya Kun. In Pakistan, TV programs such as Coke Studio in Pakistan have been instrumental in making Qawwalis a household phenomena. More recently, top Pakistani singer Ali Zafar created a buzz with his Qawwali Mawla, a tribute to Imam Ali.
Now, to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Bilal Chashti, formerly known as Dhruv Sangari before his conversion to Islam. He is a Sufi musician and scholar, singer for Ruh Sufi Ensemble from New Delhi, India. Mr. Chashti, welcome to the program, sir. Now, the Sufi tradition of Qawwali has come a long way in South Asia since Amir Khosrow Dehlavi in the 13th century. What makes it so popular and evergreen?
So now you come to the fact that the Sufi tradition and what makes it so popular. So it is this kind of syncretic blending of different traditions, right? Transgressing boundaries, blending of traditions. What we know in India as Tehzeeb-e Gango Jaman or the Majma'ul Bahrain. And it is the blending of civilizations, of traditions, to create a very long-term harmonious civilization which believes in celebrating each other's festivals, learning about each other's spiritual traditions, cultural traditions. And through that sharing comes a music, which is what is actually Qawwali. Qawwali is a success story of the secular syncretic tradition of the Indian subcontinent, actually. And in Qawwali, we see so many different forms of music are combined, from the Drupad and the Bhajan and the Kirtan of the Hindu traditions to everything from the Hamd, Qaul, Manqabat, Naat, everything, and the Marsiya of the Persio-Arabic traditions. So Qawwali is something very fluid. It doesn't have any one description. which is why in any one Qawwali concert or any one Qawwali program, even at a Sufi Dargah or a Khanqah, you will find the Durveshes, the Samakhwan, they sing a vast variety of genres. And this is why Qawwali till today is unique and appeals to people across religions, across cultures, across nations, across boundaries. And this is exactly the idea behind the Sufis propagating Qawwali in their shrines and in their khanqahs.
Mr. Chashti, Qawwalis are sung essentially in praise of Almighty Allah, Prophet Muhammad and Imam Ali, with specific focus on Manqabat of the first Shia Imam. Now, can we say or could we say that this is a celebration of love?
Most Sufis, with the exception of a few Salasil, they date back their Shijra all the way to Mawla Ali, to Hazrat Ali, Karamullahu Wajhul Kareem, and for them, one of the most important declarations of the unity of faith as represented by the Ahle Bayt Uzam and Mustafa Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam, Sarkare Dualam, is the events of the Ghadir, which take place in fact this month in Zulhijjah, where Huzur Muhammad Saab lifts up the hand of Mawla Ali radiallahu anhu, and he says, Man kuntu Mawlahu wa haza Aliyun Mawlahu. So this, and then there are other hadith where he has, and this is both shared by both Sunni and Shia, historians and muhaddis. So this is something which people have an ijma on. There's another very famous hadith which says, Ana madinatul ilm wa aliyun babuha. So such very beautiful examples of how the regardless of whoever was the administrator of some place or not, the spiritual successor of Huzur Muhammad Saab is very much, the Ahle Bayt. And to celebrate that is a very, very important part of the Sufi tradition. And it is the love of the Ahle Bayt. You know, the Ahle Bayt are described as almost like a Kashti-e-Nuh. You know, they are described as a great jahaz, a ship, where those who climb on will go celebrating in love and will be forgiven at the end. So this is a tasawwur which is extremely important. And this tasawwur has also been borrowed by people of other faiths, which is so beautiful. The Hindus, the Sikhs, they used to very actively celebrate, not celebrate, but mark the solemn occasions of, the shahadat of the imams, Muharram, the events at Karbala, and even today in the Taziyas, in the Marsiyas, in the ceremonies of a lot of the Shia community, you find there are Hindus, there are many Sunnis, there are Sufis also, there are people from the Sikh faith.
Mr. Chashti, when we talk of Urdu or Punjabi or even Persian Qawwalis, the one name that comes to mind is that of legendary Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan. How do you see his contribution in popularizing Qawwalis globally?
So Ustad Nusrat Ali Khan Sahab, Marhum Rahmatullahi Alayh, was one of the most legendary musicians of his time. In fact, a lot of people lovingly call him God of Music, if there is such a thing. But he was really, really blessed, and I was very blessed to learn from him, spend time with him in the last 1.5 to 2 years of his life. Subsequently, I was also under the guidance of late Ustad Farooq Fateh Ali Khan Sahab, who is the father of Ustad Rahat Fateh Ali Khan Sahab. So these people, they were really at their time, once in a century, you know, we see musicians like this come around.
Mr. Chashti, thank you for being on the program. He's a Sufi musician and scholar, singer for Ruh Sufi Ensemble from New Delhi, India. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Sarah Tassir, a Lahore-based designer and social activist, notes that Sufi saints such as Nizamuddin Awliya and Amir Khosrow spread the message of Islam in the subcontinent through arts like Qawwali before Mughals. Islamic scholar Omid Safi says almost every Qawwali session starts with praise of God, followed by praise of the Prophet, and then praise of Imam Ali, describing it as the model of spiritual transmission.
Holland Khan, a Sufism devotee, lauds legendary Qawwali artist Nostat Fateh Ali Khan for registering his name in the Guinness Book of World Records by recording 125 Qawwali albums.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In what turned out to be the island country's most chaotic and tumultuous day, in months-long anti-government protests, angry protesters on Saturday, July the 9th, stormed President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's residence in the Sri Lankan capital, Colombo, and called for his resignation. They also made their way into Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe's residence, setting it on fire as anger over the political and economic crisis gripping the country boiled to unprecedented levels. Protesters also ambushed the cricket stadium where the Sri Lankan team was playing against Australia.
In spectacular scenes broadcast live on Sri Lankan television and circulated widely over social media, hundreds of protesters were seen gate-crashing Sri Lankan President Gotabaya Rajapaksa's colonial-era fortified residence and office on Saturday.
The moment we are struggling to chase off Gotabaya and Ranil Wickremesinghe, the Prime Minister and President of Sri Lanka.
Images show demonstrators sitting in the president's boardroom, hanging banners from the balcony, and swimming in the small courtyard pool. Rajapaksa had fled the scene, moving to a safe location, before hell broke loose. Protesters then stormed the residence of veteran politician and sitting Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe and set it on fire. Demonstrators from different parts of the country marched to the capital, Colombo, demanding the resignation of both Rajapaksa and Wickremesinghe over deepening economic mismanagement. To draw the attention of foreign governments, they also gathered outside a cricket stadium in Sri Lanka's southern coastal city of Gale, where the home team was playing against Australia.
So we are here to purposely show the whole country that the steps taken by the government to constrict the democratic space, the democratic rights of the people of the country, is a violation of the Constitution.
In an attempt to thwart anti-government demonstrations, authorities had on Friday night imposed a stringent curfew in Colombo. But the curfew was lifted after civil society groups and opposition parties expressed their objection and protesters stood unfazed. Strung by massive public anger, President Rajapaksa finally agreed to resign. Prime Minister Wickremesinghe also said he will step down after a new government is formed.
The tumultuous events in Sri Lanka marked the culmination of months of violent anti-government protests fueled by the worst economic crisis the country has seen since its independence in 1948. What started as peaceful demonstrations in February over rampant inflation and shortage of food and fuel took a dramatic turn recently, with angry protesters laying siege to the residences of both the president and the prime minister. Observers have pinned the blame for the crisis on the Rajapaksa family, which has for decades dominated the island's politics.
Lengthy blackouts, rampant inflation, and acute shortage of food and medicine have forced people in the island country to take to the streets in large numbers in recent months. The anger over the simmering crisis in the country of 22 million has mainly been directed at the Rajapaksa family, the country's most powerful political dynasty that has dominated the political scene in Sri Lanka for almost two decades.
Actually, the current situation in the country is getting worse. There's no fuel in the country. There is no basic needs like electricity, food.
In the last few years, Sri Lankan rupee has lost more than 80% of its value. Food costs have skyrocketed, and the tourism industry remains in shambles. Last week, the government shut off fuel sales over concerns it would run out of petroleum, becoming the first country to do so since the oil crisis of the 1970s. The country also owes more than $50 billion in debt and has been unable to pay interest on its loans. Saturday's storming of the presidential palace capped months of demonstrations that the ruling establishment previously had tried to suppress. While earlier protests in May led to the exit of Prime Minister Mahinda Rajapaksa, the president himself refused to quit. If both Rajapaksa and Wickremesinghe resign, according to the country's constitution, the parliament speaker will serve as acting president until a new president is elected. The new all-party government is likely to be formed on July 20.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Saeed Khan, Director of Global Studies at Wayne State University from Detroit, Michigan. Now, Mr. Khan, first of all, welcome to the program. Now, this month's long demonstrations in Sri Lanka took a dramatic turn this week with protesters storming the residences of the country's president and prime minister. Now, did you see this coming?
I think in many ways it's not surprising that the kind of revolt we saw and the aftermath of it was heading in that direction. No one, of course, ever predicts that there's going to be essentially a palace coup. But if we take a look at what had been going on in Sri Lanka now for the last several months, the economic conditions within the country are extremely dire. The country has essentially run out of its foreign exchange. Therefore, it's unable to buy even the simplest of commodities, including petrol. There is such a shortage of petrol in Sri Lanka that, except for emergency vehicles, access to petroleum products, gasoline, is not available. And you see this having then a kind of a snowballing effect. The inflation rate is close to 55%. Simple and basic commodities are not even available because Sri Lanka relies heavily on imported goods, being an island country. And at the same time, because of the lack of foreign exchange, imported goods cannot be paid for. So it becomes this rather vicious cycle. And there was a breaking point with many people in the country. To be fair, some of this was a function of COVID, as well as the global inflation and disruptions to supply chains. But the kind of scenes that we saw at the presidential palace was in many ways just a culmination of frustration that had been building for quite a bit of time now.
Mr. Khan, you've just mentioned that the island country has been grappling with rampant inflation and acute shortage of food and medicine. Do you also hold the Rajapaksa family government responsible for the situation?
Again, I think that there are some things that simply could not be foreseen. One, of course, being COVID, which had a major impact on foreign exchange and foreign currency being available within the country, some of which could then be paid for imported goods. Tourism is a massive revenue generator for Sri Lanka. And because of COVID over the last 2 years, that was something that just simply wasn't possible. At the same time, COVID is not the explanation for everything. Sri Lanka has had a policy of favoring imported goods with a deficit of export goods. As a result of it and its trade deficit, which are, of course, all policies that are government involved, we find that a lot of the blame has to go to the Rajapaksa regimes, Prime Minister and President both, because they are brothers, on implementing policies to burnish Sri Lanka's export ability of goods, opening up newer markets for where it could sell many of Sri Lanka's very important commodities, including tea. Failure to do that, failure to take better fiscal policy measures and to prepare the country for inevitabilities is certainly then something that, as they say, the buck stops at the desk of the leadership
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Khan for being on the program once again. He is a director of global studies at Wayne State University.